You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. It is the middle of August. Oh, Don, the weather's becoming so nice. It's much cooler than it was in the last couple of weeks.
After a very rugged July here in the Sacramento Valley, August has started off great. And I'm just going to read the high temperatures for the next week that the National Weather Service is saying for whichever site I have pulled up here, because it doesn't really matter. Today, by the way, is August 14th. We're preparing the show for broadcast. You're listening to it live on August 15th. Today will be 91 degrees. And then here are the high temperatures for the next several days. 91, 91, 87, 86, 87, 91.
That is cool.
What's interesting is that's actually average. Our average high temperature here at this time of year is about 91 degrees. Start the month with an average high of 93, and it drops down to about 91 by the end of August. So for the first time in several weeks, we're going to have average weather, which means, obviously, climate-wise, averages are changing. But the good news is, after all those weeks of extremely high temperatures and low humidity and all that kind of thing, we've got some great, not just gardening weather, but fruit set weather for your summer vegetables. We've already had several days in which the blossoms are actually setting fruit instead of simply falling off because of the high temperatures. So if you have tomatoes, if you haven't given up and pulled them out or whatever, some people just got fed up by the end of July, give them a deep soaking. No, you don't need to feed them, just a really deep soaking. If they're blooming now, you'll see fruit in about 7 weeks, fruit ripening. You'll pick fruit in about 7 weeks in the case of normal sized tomatoes. Sooner in the case of cherry tomatoes, saladette tomatoes, all that kind of thing. So we are getting not just our usual August cool down, we're really getting our August cool down. I've got to give credit to one of our local TV meteorologists. I think it's Mark Finan, who used to use that term quite regularly in his weather broadcasts. August cool down occurs as we shift over. We get monsoon air coming in. We get more coastal influence here in the Sacramento Valley, and our days are much, much more pleasant. And our nights cool off into the 50s. So what are those night temperatures going to be? You had a question, ma'am?
No, I'm excited. You know, this weekend is going to be perfect fair weather. Not fair weather.
It's fair weather, yes.
Great weather for the fair. And this is, in fact, the weekend that the Yolo County Fair is happening.
The county fair.
Yolo County Fair.
Not the state fair.
No.
Okay. This is very important. This is the little Yolo County, perfectly free fair that's been going on for who knows how long. The state fair is a different thing.
And the county fair, the first day, which is Wednesday, which it's already over, that's when they did the judging for all of the animals and the 4-H and all that good stuff. And then after that, it's just fairs and exhibits and concerts at night and all sorts of things. So it opens around noon every day, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And Don says I have to give him a report next week on what the gardening situation is over there, because usually they have a house of flowers and displays and all that sort of stuff. So I'll check it out and I'll tell you next week. And if you want to come check it out, go for it.
YOLOCountyFair.net. And this is a classic county fair. This is not a great big mass of humanity and all kinds of crazy stuff going on. This is a very family-friendly county fair. It's been going on for a long, long time. You can see the nighttime events if you're interested in those. But of course, during the day, you can just go up there and look at the garden displays and the animals. And I'm sure they probably have ag machinery there, I would hope, at a YOLO.
And a huge art and photography yeah. building. And then, well, funnel cakes, Don. Funnel cakes.
Yes, all the fair food is also there. For information, YOLOCountyFair.net. YOLOCountyFair.net. I want to mention one program that's been a long-running show at KDRT, and our programmer is leaving us. That's a wrap for Time Out Radio. Rohan has just completed his 100th episode of Time Out Radio. Began in eighth grade.
What?
Produced and hosted this show through his high school years, covering sports, school, travel, recreation, generally anything else that catches his attention, plays soccer and basketball, volunteers with Special Olympics, coaches youth basketball, is a stadium announcer for FC Davis. And at show 100, Rohan is heading off to college. Thank you, Rohan, for 100 programs at KDRT, for all the volunteer work you've done here, and best wishes in your future endeavors. You can listen to the public affairs shows, and that's what this is called, forever. They archive forever at kdrt.org. You can listen to episode 100, and then you can binge on all 100 of them if you want to. That's Time Out Radio, as one of our great programmers moves on to the next stage of career. I'm guessing we'll hear more out of this young man.
Well, last week we got a bunch of questions about corn, and Don went home to do his homework. And so now we're going to answer those questions, at least I hope so. Kathy Ann Davis writes, "When I get an ear of corn, there's a tassel poking out of the husk leaves." Now, Don, is that the wrong word? Is tassel's the right word for that part that pokes out of the husk?
No, what pokes out of the corn is the silk, and the tassel is the man.
Oh, so the silk, so the tassel someplace else on the plant.
On the top, it's the flower that you see at the top. Just sprinkling pollen down below it to everyone in the state of Iowa.
All right, so she writes, "I cook one ear of corn, still in the husk, in a microwave for 4 minutes, and then I use a towel to peel off everything, both the leaves and the silk, and I cut the ends off. Insert cob skewers, run a stick of butter over it, and lightly salt. It is great." So here are my corny questions. What is the tassel for? Oh, so that should be, what is the silks for? There are hundreds of kernels of corn. There don't seem to be that many silk strings in the thing coming out the top. Does each kernel have a silk? Does one silk strand pollinate more than one kernel? How does the pollen's maleness get down to the place where the kernels are forming? Why are the kernels usually in neat rows? Why are some ears not in neat rows?
So many questions. It's corn. It's the quintessential American dish. It's interesting. Americans who travel to Europe are a little surprised to find they don't eat corn or peanuts in Europe. Apparently, it's a very, very, very American dish. And of course, came from Mesoamerica originally, staple of American diet. Ask those questions one at a time. One.
What is the silk coming out of the top for?
Well, the thing coming out of the very top of the plant is the...
No, of the corn husk.
That is the female... That is to guide, or that is part of the female flower.
Okay. Hundreds of kernels of corn. I don't think there are that many silk strings in the tassel.
Yes,
does each kernel have its own silk?
Yes.
Okay. Does one silk strand pollinate more than one kernel?
Nope.
All right. How does the pollen's maleness get down to the place where the kernels are forming?
This is a family show. It grows like a root.
Huh?
A pollen tube.
You're going to have to be more specific.
When pollen lands on what it's going to pollinate, a tube emerges, which grows out of it like a root and grows to the point that it's going to pollinate. This is every flower. And so it just grows down the silk to the female part, which later becomes the seed that you eat.
So the pollen is from a tassel on the very tippy top of the plant.
Right.
It's blowing around in the wind.
Yep.
And when a pollen
grain
lands on a silk.
Yes.
Okay. Then it grows alongside the silk, inside the silk?
Inside.
inside the silk and goes down to where the silk is attached.
Where the ovule is, where the ovule is in the female flower. And then they go out for a drink.
No, they don't. They just have a baby. So each kernel was created by
one grain of pollen.
One vein of pollen who made a really long trip, because that's a long way for a little pollen to go.
Fortunately, it happens rapidly, but this does tell you one sort of weak link in this process, which is that that's a fairly vulnerable stage. If it's very, very hot, for example, pollen is killed above, well, it varies from species to species, but on corn, my own experience has been a couple of years when I grew big blocks of corn and I got very poor ear set, very poor number of kernels on each ear. It had been extremely hot during that pollination period. Well, that silk can dry out or just be injured, or the pollen can just be directly killed by high temperature. So indeed, if you read about climate change concerns with agriculture, damage to pollination is a real critical concern. If you're a state like Iowa, which is 97% agricultural land, and the vast majority of that grows corn, and you're growing it for whatever reason, if you've got a problem with increasing temperatures and pollen sensitivity to high temperatures, you'll have yield problems. So that's just one little nugget of this whole thing, is that that's a vulnerable stage. Corn uses a lot of water. It needs to be kept well hydrated. If it goes dry during that pollination period, you can have problems with pollination. So everything has to be favorable. Good news, there's a lot of silks, and there's probably 1,000 of them, and potentially up to 800 or 1,000 kernels, but most corn only has a few hundred. So you don't get every single one of them pollinated, and you still can get a good full ear of corn. It is important that you plant your corn in blocks rather than straight rows. This is really simple because the pollen is dropping down from about 3 feet above, and it's not dropping straight down. It's blowing. We always have wind, even a couple miles an hour wind. So if you have a nice long row of corn and the pollen comes off of the tassels to go down to the silks, and it's just one straight row and the wind's coming from the wrong direction, you don't get pollination. But if you have a block, like a 4x4, 8x8, 16x16 square area planted, you'll get the movement back and forth from the wind, and the pollen will distribute more evenly. You'll get better, more full ears. That was a slight digression. Next question.
So is that, okay. So when I, Lois, get a kernel, an ear of corn, and I open it up, they're nice, big, full kernels near the base. When you get to the very tippy top, the last inch or two, the kernels are much smaller, and some they're barely there. They're just little white milky sort of things. Why does that happen?
They open gradually. The corn itself, the corn that you're eating, was an inflorescence with a whole bunch of female flowers in rows, and they do form gradually, and the plant probably just runs out of resources most likely during the period, the narrow period in which the female flowers are receptive. That's my best guess. Modern hybrids, by the way, if you're looking through, let's say, Harris Seed Catalog or places like that, how well the ears fill is actually one of the characteristics that's a selling point. So what you're looking at for a home garden variety is likely less true, and I've found it's less true for corn that's being grown for commercial purposes. How well the ears fill is something that they actually breed and select for.
Okay, so most of the times I get ears of corn that had the kernels in nice, neat, straight rows. Every once in a while, I get an ear where it's not in straight rows. It's all jumbled up. Why does that happen?
First of all, going back to the challenge posed by my grandfather when we were all little kids, he told us that he would give us $100 if we ever found an ear of corn with an odd number of rows. And we all then spent the rest of our lives counting the rows.
Did you go in and manipulate the corn so you took a row out?
That doesn't count. Granddaddy, you think, plus you couldn't do that. There's no way to do that. The inflorescence develops its very tiny primordial form, and several single rows of female flowers form first, and then they always double. They always split. So there's always two rows where one began, almost always, 99.9% of the time. One article I looked at said, odd numbers of corn are as rare as a four-leaf clover, which is a useless statistic because we have no idea how rare four-leaf clovers actually are statistically. But he's correct. My grandfather was correct. None of us ever found an ear of corn with an odd number of rows. There are, we'll get to this in a minute, some varieties of corn that don't have rows for one reason or another. And sometimes that meristem that's dividing to create the inflorescence, it's the cell division and then the separation out into particular cell types, isn't perfect. So you don't get a straight row. It'll be deformed for some reason, almost certainly having to do with adverse weather or some sudden change in nutrient or soil moisture status as the female flower was first developing long before pollination. So it's as it's developing and getting ready to become a female flower receiving pollen. And so you'll get, it's a row, but it's a little squiggly, but you for granddaddy's purposes, you would count it as a row. And sometimes they even split towards the end a little bit. So, you know, you don't have absolutely perfect rows, but in general, you do. You generally get a perfectly even number anywhere from 8, 10, 12, 14 rows of corn and generally very straight and perfect. And as they say, modern varieties filling out all the way to the end, much more so than their ancestors did.
So when you're talking about the non-neat rows, is this a, okay, are there different species of corn or is the corn that we eat all one species?
It's all generally classed as Zea. Maize, Z-E-A is the genus, maize, M-A-Y-S is the species. And in fact, corn is called maize, M-A-I-Z-E, in much of the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I think that answers all of my questions except one. This morning, I sent you a picture of a ear of corn that I saw a couple days ago that I ate. It was delicious. But it had mostly yellow kernels, but some white. Mm-hmm. Now, why would it have two different colors of kernels? I know there's white corn and yellow corn, but mixed?
There's a originally normal corn, I guess we can call it now. Sweet corn was a recessive gene. It occurred in starchy corn. And of course, immediately got selected because that was wonderful. It was producing sugar, not more sugar than starch. So humans started eating it rather than just growing corn as animal feed. And then super sweet corn and sugary enhanced corns came along and they just had more sugar, or the sugar breaks down to starch more slowly. And then in recent years, these two new categories have come along. Synergistic corn, which is a mix of kernel types on each ear. So some of the individual kernels might be more starchy and others might be more sweet, and some are yellow and some are white. And they're very tender and have very high sugar content overall, and they've become very popular. That's where those yellow and white ones on the same ear came from. And they had a big advantage, better seedling vigor, better early seedling growth than the super sweet corn. So that made them very popular with growers right away. And now we even have augmented shrunken kernel corn, which are very sweet, like super sweet, very tender kernels. The sugar breaks down more slowly in the plant, so in the corn. So if you buy it today and put it in your refrigerator, it's still very sweet 5, 6, 7 days, or even as much as 2 weeks later. That has an advantage of earlier tolerance of soil, low soil temperatures. That sentence didn't scan. Let me try that again. You can plant them earlier than the super sweets because they're more tolerant of low temperatures. So these are all introductions as time has gone by, from the finding of sweet corn 125, 150 years ago to sweet corn that would convert from sugar to starch more slowly, the super sweets, and then these ones that have a mix of kernel types to these ones that are very sweet and very tender. Some corn that you buy is so tender it's almost mushy, according to people of, say, my parents and grandparents' generation. Others are firm and give a little bite when you're chewing on them. Some people prefer that crunchy texture. But one of the biggest factors for people growing corn is whether or not the young seedlings need very perfect soil conditions. So as you're buying corn seeds in the spring, if you're doing it early, you should probably do normal or sugary enhanced corn or some of these new synergistic types. If you really want the sweetest corn there is, wait until May or even June and plant super sweets or augmented shrunken kernel types. That's a lot of information. It's all available at companies like Harris Seed and some of the other companies that sell a lot to truck farmers, small scale farm operations. The key question is, when is your soil temperature warm enough? And do you really want super sweet corn? And are you selling it? If you're selling it to a grocery store, or you're going to even have a fruit stand, you don't want it to sit out there and be converting to starch while it's sitting there for the public to buy it. You want it to hold the sweetness longer. So you'll focus in on particular varieties that have been introduced for that purpose. As a home gardener, you can get some of the sweetest, most tender corn in the world that you'll never find at a fruit stand because it doesn't hold the sweetness. You start the water boiling. My grandfather taught me this. He was from Oklahoma, okay, and Illinois. Those were his two, so those are the two places he grew up. So that's corn country. You get the water boiling, you go harvest the corn, you put it, you husk it and put it right into boiling water. And that way you get the sweetest corn there is. But there are modern corn varieties. If you see corn at the grocery store, you might go, wow, this is really sweet for a grocery store corn. Carefully chosen varieties is the reason.
So if high temperature is going to become a problem in the future, even more than it is now, then maybe the corn that can get planted earlier than the other corn is going to be our new normal, because it will be pollinated before it gets too hot.
Yeah, you can, if you can plant early, the meaning that this particular variety can take cooler soil, and you still have the advantage of very high sugar content, and it breaks down slowly, and you have a firmer texture. Let's say those are all the things you want to grow sweet corn for the market. There are varieties out there already. As with almost every bit of agricultural science, there are breeders out there working on this problem. Over the years, I grow corn almost every year, and over the years, I've had three times when very high temperatures greatly affected my crop. Twice it was because they were pollinating and we had a heat wave. They were pollinating in July. We had an extreme heat event. There was one in the 1980s when it was so high temperature that they just didn't pollinate. The plants grew. I watered them like crazy because corn really needs a lot of water, and it looked great. And then you open them up and there just weren't that many kernels. The other thing that's happened, this is the other end of the season spectrum, is I've twice had corn just about ready to harvest and we had an extreme heat event and the kernels split. And so it was spoiled. And unfortunately, a fair bit of it was spoiled. And that can be an issue depending on what kind you're growing, how tough the kernels are. So firmer textured kernels might be more desirable in that situation. There's this whole matrix of decisions that go into the decision-making process of any farmer. High temperatures during bloom, high temperatures close to harvest will be two big factors, especially since there are states in the United States where corn is the primary thing that happens. So those are concerns. And for home gardeners, we'll probably keep going back to the sweet ones and the super sweets and so on. But as with other things, there will probably be over time people gravitating to more reliable, successful varieties for one reason or another. And high temperature during bloom, high temperature towards harvest could be a factor. I happen to think corn is a great cover crop. So even if you don't happen to like corn on the cob or have a use for a whole bunch of it, one of the simplest things you can do with part of your garden, if you've had a problem with nematodes or soil diseases on tomatoes, or you're trying to choke out weeds, corn is a vigorous plant with an aggressive root system, and it'll make a solid monoculture. It makes a great cover crop in that sense, in that, let's say you're having a problem with particular summer weeds, corn will outgrow it. Corn will shade them out. And when you get done with it, even if you haven't harvested, even if you're just growing an ornamental one, which I often do, cut it off, don't pull it, cut it off at ground level. You can then take those stalks, if you're not using them in your retail store for a display, and you can just lay them down on the ground and they make a mulch that way, and they can shade out any further weeds that might be coming up. So corn is a great thing to grow as a cover crop, but if you are wanting it for particular purposes, do a little research. And the main question that usually comes up from reading the seed packets is, do I need to isolate this particular kind of corn from other kinds of corn? If you're in an area where corn is grown commercially, as we are, they grow field corn, they grow popcorn, and we have locally people growing corn for the seed companies in both Yolo and Solano counties, you should probably not plant the types that need to be isolated, because isolated means isolated from wind carried pollen. There are standards for how far that will go, 500 yards, 1,000 yards, whatever it is. You may not have control over that. And so, you know, this is not usually a big issue, but if you're reading a seed packet and it says isolate, probably not a good one for you unless you know what the cropping history is in your area.
So, okay.
What about corn?
Those were corny answers, and did it very well, Don.
Yes, thank you. My favorite still, Silver Queen. That's it's one that I plant every year if I possibly can.
Well, we got that question through our email. And if you would like to send us a question in our email, where would they send it, Don?
They would go to davisgardenshow@gmail.com.
All right. And we have another question here. This is Terry from Woodland. Hi, I love your show. I live north of Woodland and have access to the wood chips from a walnut orchard that was taken out. These, quote, arborist chips, unquote, are all walnut tree. My concern is this English walnuts were on black walnut rootstock. I have no way of knowing in any given load how much is black walnut versus English walnut. Is this a risk to my ornamental landscape, trees, shrubs, perennials? Thank you for your help. So
No,
we're talking about chips, ground chips of the wood.
Yes, walnuts contain juglone, J-U-G-L-O-N-E, which is a substance that's named for the genus of walnuts, which is juglans, J-U-G-L-A-N-S, and all walnuts and pecans and hickories contain juglone, some in greater quantities than other. Juglone is known to have allelopathic effects, that is to say, it suppresses the growth of certain plants. It's exuded from the roots of the trees. It's also in the leaves, and it's in the walnut hulls if they're lying on the ground. And I've had lots and lots of back and forth about this with people who are experts on the subject because this question comes up. And also as to whether even gardening around walnuts is a problem. In general, no. In general, if your soil is healthy, has good soil bacterial activity and good soil moisture, juglone is broken down at about the rate at which it enters the soil, which means that there is some there and it will affect some plant species. You will not find clear information about which plants are and are not affected by juglone being put into the soil on a steady, consistent basis from a tree that's growing there. A tree that's chopped down, chipped up. Someone asked a question several years ago, how long does that juglone stay in the ground? And so this came up on the Garden Professor's blog back when they allowed much longer conversations. And Dr. Linda Chalker-Scott and I had a long conversation back and forth about it, because she actually doesn't think that juglone or walnuts are a real problem for most people in general. She thinks it's way overstated. And I agree with her. I think it is way overstated. What it came down to, we really concluded, was there'd not been any scientific studies in peer-reviewed journals, published data showing this is what walnuts do when they're growing near other plants. It would be hard to construct such a study. It would take a very long time to measure the results. It's the kind of thing where you'll start it now, and 20 years from now, you may have some publishable data. We did, though, find that juglone, like anything that goes into the soil, is broken down by a particular soil bacteria that immediately start multiplying in the presence of this additive. It doesn't matter really what the additive is that you put in your soil. Something will start breaking it down. And whatever that is, these soil bacteria that break down juglone increase rapidly in the presence of juglone and break it down until it goes back to the previous equilibrium. It seems to take about a year to get rid of the stuff from the roots of a tree, maybe 2 years, but it's declining, it's diminishing, and that's from the roots. Just grinding up the stuff and putting it on the surface doesn't have any adverse impact. That's the key. There have been studies informally that I've seen about making mulch from eucalyptus, which have again have the same reputation as having things that suppress the growth, and walnuts. And they found that if you mulch heavily with these things, the one thing that it will do is it will suppress the growth of things from seed. Well, there we go. Like weeds, for example. So that's got, could be an advantage. If you're trying to, let's say, scatter California poppies, I don't know if this would be a problem, but it might affect them because they're trying to germinate into the little zone where there might be enough juglone to make some difference during the time period while it's still breaking down. So maybe throwing out your California wildflower mix onto an area heavily mulched with walnut wood chips wouldn't be great. You should probably plant plants instead. But planting and then mulching around plants seems to have no adverse effect. That's the general conclusion of all the limited studies I could look at, was it's okay to use this stuff, even if it's from walnuts, even if it's from black walnut, on the surface. Right at that surface interface with the native soil, you have two things. You have a little bit of nitrogen tied up right there. That's something you'll run into if you're reading about this online. What about nitrogen? Right measurably at the point of contact of the wood chips in the soil? Yeah, there's nitrogen involved in the decomposition at that particular layer. 2 inches down, no impact. So the plants that are mulched are not affected by that, by the nitrogen issue. And the supposed toxicity of the jugalone is not a factor any deeper than where it's present either. So basically, it makes a little layer where seedlings might have trouble rooting through. Other than that, no impact on, as noted, the trees, the shrubs, the perennials, or existing annual plants that are already there. So the only concern I would have would be planting into it. In other words, going out and buying some pansies and pulling back the wood chips and trying to plant a pansy there. I don't think it would have an adverse effect, but it might. Or things that you're trying to grow from seed. So it might affect your ability to scatter seed. Of course, so would 4 to 6 inches of wood chips. So this wouldn't probably be an issue in most cases. But I would say that in general, you don't need to worry about it. Especially if you're talking about established landscape plants.
When you talk about jugalone, in all the stuff you read, I heard you say it is present in the roots of the tree, sure, and it's present in the leaves and in the husks of the nuts. Now, does that mean that it's not present in the growing wood of the tree?
It's present.
Did you see that? It's
undoubtedly distributed all through the tree. It's there. And then one thing is they've extracted this substance and they've used it in greenhouse experiments. You can find greenhouse data on what it does to seedlings, for example, and you can extract it from any part of the plant. It's apparently pretty concentrated in the leaves and especially the husks around the walnut itself, which drop on the ground and is coming out of the roots as well. But the ground up tree has jugalone in it. There's no question, but it breaks down reasonably quickly and doesn't appear to have any adverse effect if it's just put on the surface. No, you don't incorporate it, but you wouldn't do that anyway. Incorporating it would actually be more of an issue with that nitrogen concern than with the jugalone, apparently. So anyway, arborist wood chips made from walnut, I think, are fine. We know that this first came up with eucalyptus. Those are also fine with some limited issues. And the worst that would happen, I've had plants under walnuts fail to thrive. We had a big walnut tree in our backyard. They would just look anemic. That was pretty much the symptom, was that they didn't die or anything. They just didn't thrive and they looked anemic. I've got a well with pH of our water 8.2, so that might be a factor as well. but right next to them would be plants that were growing. So here's the thing. You go online to look up black walnut allelopathy or whatever version of that you're going to do in your Google search. And up will come all these great lists of plants that are affected by and resistant to jugalone. And Dr. Chalker Scott's comment was there was absolutely no evidentiary basis for those lists other than observations by naturalists. There's nothing wrong with observations by naturalists, but they aren't really science. They aren't really scientific evidence. They are, I was looking at this area and the flowering quince was looking anemic and yet the colquitia was doing great. So colquitia goes on the okay list and flowering quince goes on the not okay list. Those are just random examples, folks. Okay, don't worry about it. And these they're not useful lists really at all. So they're just based on observation. Observations are great, but that doesn't tell you the other big factor. What's the soil activity in terms of bacterial microbes that will attack the jugalone? What's the moisture status? I would imagine that very dry soils, jugalone probably breaks down more slowly than in well-irrigated soils. So there's other environmental factors that really come into play. But the bottom line is that allelopathy and the impact of jugalone is really overstated. I think that's the take home from all of this. I wouldn't hesitate personally to mulch with wood chips derived from walnut trees. But again, there's the one factor that possibly seedlings would have trouble establishing. And it may be that there's the one plant you have there that gets anemic or something. Well, that might be an impact. But I don't think you're going to see anything negative across the whole landscape.
Thank you, Terry, for writing in. And I hope that you have a good time with your wood chips. I do not have a chip report this week. I'll have a chip report for you next week.
Okay.
All right. So now I have a thing that says some recent topics to review more or less quickly. So I'll ask the question, Don will answer it, and we'll try to move right along on this part.
Yep. Okay.
Peach pits are splitting, Don.
Yeah, we've had some interesting effect from the extreme heat in July, and we've had some people coming in asking because their peaches, so they cut into them, they look fine from the outside, and they're spoiling around the pit, and in some cases, the pit has split. It looks one thing. I always cut into fruit before I bite into it. Strongly recommend that. Yeah. Well, not everybody does that. You hand them a peach, they're ready to bite right in. Go, oh, wait a minute. Sometimes little bugs get in there. And they often blame these poor little beetles that fall away. If there's any injury or spoilage that starts, these little black beetles get in there and start to feed on it. And people think, I have beetles on my fruit tree. I need something to spray for the beetles. No, you had something else that caused it. But the splitting of the pits, although it in of itself is not a problem because, you know, you're going to pull that out anyway, it can lead to spoilage right around the pit. And I don't know for sure whether that spoilage occurs before the pit split, as with pit burn on apricots, or whether it's something that's just from the injury and then the flesh of the fruit as it begins to ripen rapidly decays because of bacteria getting in there. But the only things that apparently are factors in peach split pit, say that 10 times fast, are excessive thinning. How would you do that? Take off.
Excessive thinning?
This came up on two websites, both of which were EDU sites. Taking off too much fruit as it was developing, because we always tell you to thin your peaches. Well, if you take too much of it, it might somehow encourage pit, split pit. Okay. Or
Don, maybe it's that the peaches were going to be all crammed together, and so they were going to stay small. And you took away everything but one, and now, oh, all of a sudden, it can grow. And if the kernel grows too much, it might split the pit. What do you think about that idea?
I think it's just as plausible as anything else I can think of. But this is the one that seems more likely. Irregular watering during the pit hardening stage. Almost all of our problems here in the Sacramento Valley are from irregular watering, so that's the best. And then they make the sort of gratuitous comment, avoid thinning until after pits are mature and hard. How is the home gardener going to know that? Just out of curiosity. So that doesn't seem like the most useful data point. But I think the irregular watering is our key. Very high temperatures with irregular watering are the most likely factor in split pit and pit burn, which some people did report on their later varieties of apricot. That's just spoilage of the fruit right around the pit on apricots in particular. I'm quite sure it can occur on other stone fruits. It just is a particular problem on apricots. Next.
Okay, next question. Someone came in and said, well, we had aphids on our vegetable plant, so we sprayed them with vinegar and baking soda. The plant died.
Yeah, what, you know,
they killed the plants, Don.
if you ever go into retail, you learn how to have a poker face when someone says something like this, because what you want to do is go, you did what? But you don't do that.
Why would you spray vinegar and baking soda on your plants and kill them?
Because they read online that those were good things for pests on plants. So let's talk about them. First of all, good thing they didn't mix them together. Vinegar and baking soda is the classic fourth grader's approach to making a volcano for a science fair, because if you put them together, they fizz. You know that. Kids, try this at home with supervision. But both of them are recommended frequently on these kinds of websites that are, hey, here's a homespun remedy you can do. Why bother using a pesticide? Just pull this out of your kitchen cabinet and use it. And there's usually a little kernel of truth to some of this. But in the case of vinegar, if you do a little digging, you also find it's recommended as a weed killer. Huh. Mm-hmm. So something that would kill weeds, spraying it on your cucumber plant doesn't seem like a real good plan. And indeed, it was not a good plan. Now, obviously, the dose makes the poison. That's the fundamental principle of pesticide toxicity. So it probably depends on how dilute they did it. Here's a question. How would you know how much to dilute it? Because there's no label. It's not a pesticide. The advantage of going and buying a product specifically for a pest on a particular crop or plant is that it's been tested. There's a label that tells you how much to use, a teaspoon, a tablespoon, two tablespoons per gallon, per quart, per what. It gives you instructions about, say, high temperatures above which you don't want to do it because you might burn the foliage. It gives you information on how to protect yourself. Now, you might not think that vinegar is very toxic, but acetic acid can be purchased by people 10, 20, 30% strength. That's very dangerous. So if you're using that, you should read the label and you should read it carefully before you buy it. You probably won't buy it after you read that label. So the dose makes the poison. I don't know what strength she did, but it's quite possible that burnt the leaves. And then that brings us to baking soda. Baking soda is like the Epsom salts of 2024. We were seeing all the recommendations for Epsom salts year after year. Do this, do that. Use it on this, use it on that. Now, all of a sudden, for whatever reason, all kinds of home garden guru type folks are telling you to use baking soda. Sodium bicarbonate. Sodium bicarbonate. So it's not table salt, it's not sodium chloride, but it's still sodium, which can be toxic to plants at surprisingly low doses. And sodium bicarbonate was tested. Here's the kernel of truth. Was tested years ago when they were trying to find some preventative for powdery mildew on cucurbit crops in hoop houses in the desert, in Israel and places like that. Powdery mildew can be a severe problem. They're looking for preventative sprays, and someone had discovered that sodium bicarbonate at a certain dilution sprayed before you had powdery mildew could help prevent powdery mildew. So some researchers took that one step further and tested on roses to test. Now, please listen to the whole thing before you jump up and go run out and get your baking soda. Tested on rose bushes to prevent powdery mildew and perhaps other diseases. And they found that this actually worked, except that it also fried the foliage in many cases. So that powdery mildew was gone, but the leaves looked burnt. And with roses, it turned out it was some varieties, but not others. So how are you ever going to make a recommendation based on that when there's 10,000 rose varieties out there in the trade? You're going, well, it's burning the sterling silver and not the Chrysler Imperial. That would be a long label they would have to make for that to be something that would be useful to home gardeners. In fact, those researchers quickly moved from sodium bicarbonate to potassium bicarbonate, because potassium bicarbonate did not burn leaves. And you can actually go to a garden center, not mine, but some, and buy potassium bicarbonate sprays to prevent mildew on some vegetables and on roses. Not baking soda, okay? Not for insects, as a preventative for a disease. And yet, because of this kind of thing, this morphs into sprayer plants with vinegar and baking soda if you have some kind of an unknown pest. The first absolute key thing is you never spray anything unless you know what you're spraying for. So you need to get the pest problem identified first. Otherwise, you're doing ready, shoot, aim. You're seeing you have a problem, you're seeing you have a symptom, and you're going, you're spraying something, and then you're going to the garden center to ask what to use for the pest problem after you've actually probably killed the plant with the things you sprayed. This is why you look for pesticides that have been labeled and tested. Late pesticides are very safe, low toxicity, even organic pesticides you can use for whatever your pest is, but it's not going to be the same pesticide for a fungus as it is for spider mites or aphids. And you need to identify the pest first. Then you need to monitor it and make sure it really is a problem. Make sure it is actually increasing. Make sure it's actually stressing the plant. The mere presence of some aphids isn't that big a deal. Then you take the first thing you do is you take the safest, least toxic step you can. Alternative, washing with water, making plants more open. In other words, if you get a whitefly problem and your plants are really tangled and overgrown, there's lots of things that feed on whiteflies. Doing a little pruning and strategic separating to make it more open will actually give surprising access to the beneficial insects, and you'll often find the problem solves itself. So taking non-lethal, non-pesticide remedies first, the least toxic alternative. Then finally, if it's clearly adversely affecting the plant, likely to adversely affect your yield, making it, so that you need to do something, you would go get a pesticide which has been tested and labeled for that product. Home remedies have the drawback of being potentially very harmful to the plant and sometimes harmful to you. So much fun as it may be to make your own pesticides and try to deal with things that way, you're asking for trouble. She fried her plant by trying to use something that wasn't a pesticide. And in fact, just for the record, if you're using it to kill a pest, it's a pesticide. It's just not labeled as such. It's really actually illegal to recommend things for pest control that aren't labeled pesticides. And this comes up very frequently. I couldn't do it. If you walked into my store and I said, I just spray that with vinegar, that's against the law, because I don't have vinegar that's labeled for that. And the key thing is to buy the least toxic alternative if you're going to use a spray at all, and follow the label directions. The label is the law. The wording of the label is guided by federal law. The words are chosen exactly based on the toxicity and the necessary precautions that you would take. That's why you use something that's actually labeled. I know it's frustrating that you have to actually buy something. Well, you don't. That monitoring thing comes back into play. A lot of pest problems come and go. It's very common for aphids to increase rapidly, plateau, drop off rapidly before you ever see any significant injury to the plant. And you can help with that by the things we often recommend, like the vigorous rinsing to sort of reset the population a couple of times until, say, the natural predators come along and do their job. So very commonly, it is not necessary to use a pesticide. And personally, I haven't sprayed anything in my vegetable garden in more than 40 years. I don't ever need to. I just rinse with water. I monitor. The problem goes away or the crop is done, and I'm not too concerned about it. So just learning what the pests are, what their cycles are, knowing that most things have about a 2 to 6 week cycle maximum and generally don't adversely affect the growth or yield that much. And knowing when to take action, there's a technical term for that, but when you would actually take action against it and what you would do, and starting with that least toxic alternative is really the best bet.
So our next question from this list of really quickly answered questions. Yeah. People came in asking about starting seeds now for cool season vegetables. What do you start in August?
Well, all the brassicas are going in now or getting ready. I mean, my growers are seeding six packs and trays of them for you to buy. Actually, they're available now. I'll have my, because of this incredible weather, I'm bringing in a bunch of broccoli this week. So it is time. It's the beginning of the fall planting season already. And it's hard to imagine when it was 100 and something, but it actually feels, you know, suitable this year with the temperatures in the upper 80s to around 90. There's no hurry. But this is the time to get going on the old-fashioned forms of broccoli, the old-fashioned forms of cauliflower that need to get a really good early start. You're actually a little late for your rutabagas. Better get going quickly on those. Brussels sprouts need to go in August from plants, so you're probably better off just buying some of those. I mean, it's always great to see people planning and getting excited about this, but the real problem is, and this was a direct conversation that I had with this particular customer, where are you going to do them? Where are you going to start them that is going to be an easy place for you to manage seedlings at this time of year? Because her comment was, well, should I do them indoors? No. Brassica is the term we use for all of the members of that genus, Brassica, species Oleracea, cauliflower, cabbage, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, forgetting some, that all of them are brassicas. Coal crops is the other term for them. As soon as they sprout, like many seedlings, they stretch very rapidly. The hypocotyl, which is the part between the seedling leaves, the cotyledon leaves and the soil, just keeps expanding, keeps stretching in low light conditions, and they'll flop over. They're very, very vulnerable to seedling diseases at that stage. They need to be outside where they have bright indirect light would be best, or morning sun, shade in the afternoon. And they need to be where there's some air movement to thicken those stems, or else they'll just be ungainly plants that won't transplant well. If you have to do them indoors, a grow light setup is going to be your best bet. And then moving them as quickly as you can outside. But they become leggy very quickly. It's a very unsatisfactory project for most people. That's why most people buy starts of the brassicas. Try to move them outside for at least a couple of hours each day so they get some light air movement to help strengthen the stems. When we're doing them in our little office germination chamber upstairs at our nursery, we have little tiny fans, little kind of fans that would be near your computer, that are just pointed towards the whole seedling area so that there's some air movement to help thicken them, bearing in mind that the fan will dry out the soil. Outdoors in a sheltered location can work really well. And when I said that, she goes, "What do you mean by sheltered?" I said, "Well, not in a lot of wind and not in a lot of sun, but some sun and some wind, okay, near your front door, under the shade of a high tree." Most people who really get into this end up making a germination station somewhere around their house, because they can do these things in a place where it's easy to water, because you're going to have to water at least once a day, probably twice a day if it's windy. So find a place where it'll be easy to do that, where they'll get some sun and some air movement. Shaded in the afternoon, out of the wind is best. So then, of course, your next question is, well, should I direct seed them in the ground? Well, I hate to be a downer. That works. They come up quickly. You will certainly have to water daily in full sun. That's fine. Full sun is okay. They want to know if they need to shade them because these are cool season plants. No, the seedlings are fine in full sun, but they're little tiny plants. And so the rest of your vegetable garden now, you're probably able to water deeply less often because they're big established plants. No, these little seedlings will need water at least once a day, probably twice a day. And the other real issue is that everything likes to eat brassica seedlings, and so you'll definitely need to cover them. So a real simple thing that we've talked about before, you've been eating strawberries and blueberries and saving those little green baskets that they come in. And so you just go out and you find your drip emitter and you sprinkle two or three seeds of whatever it is you're growing, broccoli, and you water it in, and then you push one of those strawberry baskets over the top of it. And that just stays on there until they've sprouted and grown up and are pushing up against it. That gets it past the bird stage, possum stage, squirrel stage, rat stage, at least for the initial part of the season. But even still, young seedlings of these plants tend to be very, very attractive to various large mammals. So daily watering will be necessary, twice a day may be necessary if the wind is blowing. And you might find little mini sprinklers instead of drippers will work better for the cool season vegetables. This is why most of my customers just buy young seedlings rather than starting their own from seed, because seedlings of cold crops are available. They're easy. They transplant out fine. Then you have to deal with the aphids and the caterpillars, but that's a different conversation.
Okay. So someone came in and said they stopped watering their lawn to kill it.
Mm-hmm.
Now what?
Well, he showed me a picture.
They killed it, right?
Yeah, they killed. Well, here's the thing. They killed most of it. But they probably didn't kill the most important part. So if you stop,
they didn't kill the weeds, did they?
No, and they didn't kill, if there's Bermuda grass, they probably didn't kill it. It just turned brown. So when you stop watering your lawn for several weeks, the middle of June, and now it's early August is when I had this conversation. So 6 or 7 weeks without watering, you can kill or seriously injure the shallower rooted grasses, such as your perennial ryegrass, bluegrass, some of the fine fescues, not all of them, and some of the annual weeds would probably die. But many other plants that are in your lawn, which of course is a population of species, many of those species have strategies that allow them to survive drought, even an entire summer of drought. Tall fescue, which is a common lawn, it's the wider bladed turf. Some of the fine fescues, Bermuda grass for sure, nut sedge. Most of the perennial broadleaf weeds that you might be dealing with have some way of storing either water or energy or something, so that once the irrigation returns, whether by rainfall or you deciding it's time to plant, they'll come back even from very prolonged drought. So basically, they have killed their lawn, but they haven't killed the undesirable things that were in their lawn. Some of those things will return as soon as they resume irrigation. I guarantee Bermuda grass and nut sedge all summer without water would be fine. They just wouldn't come up again until next year, very likely. So neither of them have been killed just by drought. So what's next is, you've got five options, but they're really quick. Heavy mulching with arborist wood chips. Sounds familiar? Or straw. Well, either of those. Just smother what's still there. Just put it on, smother whatever is left. Cover it with black plastic. You better water first, but that's one way of killing any green living thing, simply by excluding sunlight so they can't photosynthesize, which is what the wood chips do also. You can cover with clear plastic, and you'll read about solarization, and I'll tell you bluntly, I don't think it's real effective, and I really don't think it's effective on perennial weeds, and you probably don't have enough time now, but it's interesting to read about. That's where you use clear plastic after irrigating so that the soil heats up high temperature enough, 130, 140 degrees, to kill the plants that are still alive and actually kind of pasteurize the top few inches as well. Sheep mulching, easy to find articles about sheep mulching, ucanr.edu. There's a great article. That's where you do the cardboard and the mulch and all that kind of stuff. And that's just another principle of excluding light so the plants can't photosynthesize. It doesn't matter to me whether you use wood chips, straw, black plastic, sheet mulching. It's all the same idea. Plant can't photosynthesize. It can't live. You can pay someone to remove all the turf with a sod cutter. That's expensive, and I guarantee it won't get the Bermuda grass or nut sedge out. So if you have either of those two, you probably should adopt another strategy. And if you contact a landscape contractor, it is possible they will recommend spraying any actively growing plants with a well-known systemic herbicide. That's kind of your checklist of options. Prevent photosynthesis by mulching, remove it mechanically, spray it with a chemical. Those are the choices.
Well, Don, what about buying some sod, you know, those layers and layers of new grass, and putting that down?
Sure. And the weed.
Won't that block out the weeds?
No. The weeds will, if it depends on what they are. I mean, this is the thing. The first question I have to ask people when they walk in and say, I've got a whole lot of weeds. What do? I have to say, sorry to ask this question. What are your weeds? Oh, I don't know. They're just weeds. Well, every weed has its own unique adaptive strategy. It has some way of outwitting us. And for many of them, it's just a matter of being having a way of storing and waiting. Nuts edge is a good example. It can, next spring, it'll come up, even if you think you've killed it out now. Roll sod over it, it'll push right through the sod, no problem. So if you have perennial weeds that are difficult, Bermuda grass, nuts edge, morning glory, those three in particular, you better decide what you're going to do about those before you replant the area. That doesn't mean you can't replant the whole thing. His intent is to put in native plants, and that's cool. One thing I would say about that, mulching with arborist wood chips is a really good option there, because you can go ahead and go to your native plant sales this fall and go to nurseries when there's really good inventory of California natives, and you're buying shrubs and perennials. You're going to put them 3 to 5 feet apart. You can just pull back the wood chips in one place, dig a hole down there, loosen the soil, plant in that, pull the wood chips back around them. Watch carefully to make sure no weeds push through in that one particular spot. And you're still suppressing the weeds 2 feet away, 3 feet away with that thick layer of chips. So you don't have to put this whole project off until you've taken care of every difficult to control weed. But if you do have difficult perennial weeds, Bermuda grass, nuts edge, morning glory, there are others, but those are the three big ones that people really have to contend with. Don't plant in those areas until that's resolved. Just keep them mulched. Monitor them. Monitor, monitor, monitor. It seems to be a theme today. Monitor them so that you are continuing to pile stuff on them if you have to. You know, use a chemical if you're okay with that. Dig them out if that's appropriate, if it'll actually work in the case of a particular weed. But don't go out and buy a Salvia clevelandii, plant it where there's some Bermuda grass, and expect it to, you know, to hold its own real well. In the long run, woody plants that you choose at those native plant sales and at your local garden center can be a very important part of your weed control strategy. I have our California native salvias like clevelandii, Pozo Blue, Dara's Choice in several places on my farm. Nothing grows through them once they're established. They're a solid cover. They're 2 to 5 feet tall. They're 6 to 10 feet across. Nothing grows through them. And so they effectively suppress weeds once established. It's the first 1 to 3 years when you have to make sure those weeds don't come back and choke them out. But once they're established, they will shade out and crowd out other weeds. Other plants that do that, Artemisia Powis Castle, Tuscan Blue Rosemary, rock roses, cistus. There's many, many plants, including some California natives, that will shade out and eventually suppress weeds. But I wouldn't plant in an area where you have a difficult to control perennial weed. That doesn't mean you can't start your project this fall. This is one of the things we run into, the two impediments people make for themselves. I have to change the whole irrigation system. No, you don't. You just use it differently. You might modify it somewhat, but you can probably work with your existing system, even if they're lawn sprinklers. You're just going to use them differently. And the other is, I have to get everything out of there before I can start planting. No, just don't plant where that's going to be a challenge. But you probably have large areas, based on his picture, large areas you could start planting now, as long as you have a plan in mind and you're following that plan. It doesn't matter if part of it waits a year or waits until next spring.
So I'm going to ask you a question. I want a yes or no answer.
Okay.
And we'll go into the details next week.
Okay.
Question is, can we grow Japanese maples here in Davis?
Well, you and I are both doing it.
So the answer is yes.
The answer
and then
is yes.
Details of how to go about it, I think that's going to have to wait.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.